Hello and welcome to this latest Fraser of Allender podcast. My name is Emma Congreve and today we'll be discussing Scotland's adult social care system for people with learning disabilities. Now there's a good reason why we're discussing this today. Recently we published a report presenting evidence on how Scotland's social care system is and is not supporting adults with learning disabilities. This came in the same week as the Scottish Government's much anticipated independent review of adult social care. Around the same time, we received some really sobering figures on the impact of COVID on people with learning disabilities in Scotland. These interim findings came from the Scottish Learning Disability Observatory, based at the University of Glasgow, and they show that people with learning disabilities have been twice as likely to become infected and three times more likely to die from COVID-19 than the rest of the population. And this reflects some very stark pre-existing health inequalities in the population. Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by some guests from Shared Lives Plus to talk about their experiences of a really interesting model of social care. And so there's a lot to discuss, and to help me through it, I'm joined by my colleague and main author of the report, Rob Watts. So Rob, I thought we could start by talking through the findings of our report. And firstly, what is this report all about?
Hi Emma, thanks for having me. So this report is part of an ongoing research project that we have at the Fraser of Allender Institute, looking at outcomes for adults with learning disabilities in Scotland. Now, when we say outcomes, this is quite a broad research project looking at many different aspects of social policy that people with learning disabilities have told us are important to them. But it all ties in with the Scottish Government's economic priorities around inclusive growth and building a well-being economy. This is a group of the population where outcomes on pretty much every measure of well-being that we have been consistently inferior to the rest of the population. So, if we're serious about delivering inclusive growth, then people with learning disabilities need to be part of that. Later in the project, we'll be touching on themes like employment and the social security system, for example. But in our latest report, we focus on the support that's available for adults with learning disabilities through the social care system. We wanted to do three things with this: understand the difference that this support makes to people's lives, examine how recent changes to the sector have impacted this support, and consider where we go from here as we recover from the pandemic. We did this by examining quite a wide evidence base, drawing on quantitative data and other evidence already in the public domain, using some financial analysis that we conducted last year, and collecting qualitative data through interviews with professionals who work in the sector, and of course, people with learning disabilities themselves.
So for those who aren't familiar, what do we mean by support for people with learning disabilities?
Yeah, good question. So throughout most of the 20th century, many people with learning disabilities were basically shut away from society by being placed in institutions for often very long periods of time. But the decades leading up to 2010 saw a gradual move towards community-based support. There was a real drive to close all of these long-stay institutions around the turn of the century, and that was matched with financial investment to establish support systems in the community. And what that looks like today in terms of support varies for each individual, because this is a very diverse population. But just to give some examples, people can be supported to do activities they enjoy. Community clubs can enable social interaction and friendships. Day centres can offer learning opportunities and purposeful activities. Someone with profound and multiple learning disabilities might receive specialist care, perhaps in an adult care home. Housing is a really important form of support. There are supported living services, which are like a combination of suitable accommodation and personal care. And then on top of this day-to-day support, people can get help planning for the future, such as support managing finances or employability programs to help people into work. It really depends on the circumstances of the individual. Now, the system is a little complex, but to put it simply, to access support, you need to meet eligibility criteria once you have your needs assessed. support is then delivered by local authorities, third sector, and independent providers too. The system is largely publicly funded, although there are charges for some services.
So you mentioned changes in the lead up to 2010, and what has changed since then?
Yeah, there's been huge changes over the last decade. So The Keys to Life was published in 2013. That's the Scottish Government's learning disability strategy. The process of integrating health and social care is well underway. Self-directed support was introduced, which is designed to give the individual more choice and control over the support they receive. And all of this has happened against a changing financial backdrop within the public sector. As we know, this has been particularly stark at a local government level, which is where the social care system is delivered.
So given all of this, what did our research find?
Well, the main clear conclusion is that the system is not doing enough to enable people to live safe, secure, and fulfilling lives. Now, there's five reasons why we reached this conclusion. So first, the changing financial backdrop in the public sector has resulted in the loss of some non-statutory support. So local authorities have legal obligations to deliver some support services, and these have largely been protected from cuts. But this means that non-statutory services have been more vulnerable. And in many ways, this contradicts the Keys to Life, because the Keys to Life is not just focused on the delivery of health and social care services. It talks about the importance of people with learning disabilities accessing their human rights, having relationships and friendships, paid employment opportunities, living independently as part of society. But a lot of the support that enables people to achieve these things is not protected by these statutory obligations and has been scaled back. Second, the pandemic has had a very detrimental impact on people with learning disabilities. You mentioned earlier the evidence emerging around the direct impact of the virus itself, but also support packages for many people have had to be withdrawn or changed because of restrictions. Now, the good news is that we've seen plenty of evidence of support being delivered in more innovative ways, like using video calling technology, for example. And a lot of this might persist after the pandemic, but there is concern that some support that was there before won't return after the pandemic, when really the opposite needs to be true if people are to recover from the harms created over the past year. Third, adults with learning disabilities are not given enough support to make informed decisions about their lives, including decisions about the care and support they receive. And this means that a lot of the theoretical benefits behind self-directed support, like choice and control for service users, are not being realized by people with learning disabilities. Fourth, young people and their families need more support as they transition from the education system to adult health and social care services and into adulthood in general. We've heard really powerful testimonies of how important transition support is for young people with additional support needs to understand their rights and access the support that can enable them to achieve their ambitions in life. But transition support doesn't appear to be happening in a systematic or structured way for everyone. And finally, housing is a cornerstone of independent living, but there's an undersupply of quality accommodation for people with learning disabilities, and this constrains choice and results in delays. We heard one example of a man who's looking to move out of his family home because his parents are in their 70s, but he's waited 8 years to be offered suitable accommodation.
We mentioned earlier that the Scottish Government has recently done a review of adult social care. How do our findings tie in with that?
Well, ultimately, the findings from our work raise questions about what the system of support for adults with learning disabilities is there for. Is it there to help people get by and avoid a crisis? Or is it there to act as an enabler for people to live a fulfilling life and access their human rights? And the review of adult social care touches on that dichotomy, if you like. For example, it talks about the need to shift the paradigm and think about social care not as managing need, but as enabling rights and capabilities. So I guess our findings chime with a lot of what the review says. Of course, as researchers, we're presenting evidence and not advocating policies, whereas the review proposes a national care service. So it looks like there might be some big changes on the way. And with the election and a recovery from the pandemic on the horizon, it does look like we're at a key decision point. What our report highlights is that for people with learning disabilities who make up a large proportion of social care users, their experience of the social care system is not always the same as other groups, for example, older people, and any changes to the system need to bear this in mind.
Thanks, Rob. That's really interesting. So you spoke with Shared Lives Plus last week, and I think we're going to hear it from them now.
Yes. During this research, we have heard many success stories and examples of good practice, which we're keen to highlight. As we consider the future of support services for people with learning disabilities, one model of care and support has delivered notably positive outcomes, and that's shared lives schemes. So we wanted to find out more, and I spoke to some guys from Shared Lives Plus last week. So let's listen to what they had to say. So I'm delighted to be joined by Leslie Stevenson of Shared Lives Plus, which is a membership organisation for shared life schemes, shared lives carers and home share schemes. So Leslie, can you give us an overview of how this model of care works?
Sure. So Shared Lives is a model of adult social care that offers a professional care service within the environment of a family home. So what happens in Shared Lives is an adult who needs long-term support is matched carefully with a Shared Lives carer by their local Shared Lives scheme. Shared Lives carers are carefully approved, they're trained and they're self-employed. And the Shared Lives placements can take three forms. They can be long-term live-in arrangements where the supported person lives in the family, lives with the family and shares family life and community life with them. It can take the form of day support, or it can take the form of short breaks as well. But I think the key thing is that people who are supported in Shared Lives and the Shared Lives carer choose who they are matched with based on their compatibility as people. And that relationship is supported by the Shared Lives scheme, and the Shared Lives scheme in turn is inspected by the Care Inspectorate under the Adult Placement Regulations.
So who can Shared Lives schemes support? Is it suitable for people with learning disabilities, for example?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Shared Lives has really developed as a model to support people with learning disabilities. It's been around in Scotland for over 30 years now. It really developed around the time of the closure of hospitals for people with learning disabilities. And so traditionally, it has been used mostly to support adults with learning disabilities. But actually, it now supports people with a very wide range of needs, including some very complex needs. So across Scotland, a lot of people are supported in Shared Lives because they have a learning disability, but a lot are also supported because they have a need associated with old age, for example, including dementia. Some are supported because of mental ill health or a physical disability. And across the UK, it's been developed for a wide range of different groups, for example, for care leavers, for survivors of domestic abuse, even as a home from hospital service as well. So it's a very flexible model which is capable of supporting a wide variety of needs.
And what does the evidence tell us about the cost and quality outcomes of shared lives?
Sure. Well, if we're thinking about the quality, if we just even look at the Care Inspectorate gradings, in the past year, so 2019-20, the majority of schemes, 78% of schemes, received a grade of very good or excellent. None received a grade lower than a good. So these are sector-beating results. And we know that because people live as part of a family, they're able to fulfill lifelong ambitions, learn new skills. The outcomes can be transformative for the individuals. In Shared Lives Plus, we have an outcome measuring tool for people who use Shared Life services. And in that, people consistently tell us that people in Shared Lives feel part of the family. They have an improved social life. They have more friends. They're more involved in their community, all thanks to their Shared Lives carers. They've got more control over the choices they make, and they've got improved physical and mental health. There's also independent research from the University of Kent about the costs, the effectiveness, and the outcomes of Shared Lives. Here in Scotland, we have evidence about Shared Lives Moray, which is a scheme that largely provides day support, supporting older people and people with dementia. And it talks about how Shared Lives support there provides a really valuable source of early intervention and prevention. It helps people stay at home for longer, and it helps unpaid family carers stay well too. So the outcomes are really what matters. But there's interesting evidence about the financial benefits of Shared Lives as well. So a few years ago, there was an independent report commissioned which found evidence of the cost effectiveness of Shared Lives. So it found that for adults with learning disabilities, there were annual cost savings of £26,000 per person per year. But we know in Scotland that that's quite a conservative figure, and we know that there are some arrangements in Scotland where the savings are in excess of £100,000 per person per year. And the other thing I would say as well is that Shared Lives arrangements tend to be really stable, and because people are choosing to spend their lives together based on their compatibility, you find that the arrangements are very stable, and there are numerous examples of live-in arrangements that have been in place for many years, even for decades as well.
Now that all sounds really positive, but how widely used is Shared Lives across Scotland?
So across Scotland, there are 15 Shared Lives schemes. Eight of those run by local authorities and the remainder by third sector providers. So in the last year that we've got data for, the year ended March 2020, there were over 550 people in Scotland receiving support through Shared Lives. And there were over 361 people working as Shared Lives carers. So it is a very small proportion of social care provision in Scotland. But I think it's interesting to note that it is a sector that's been growing a lot in recent years. So in the 3 years before the March 2020 lockdown, the number of people supported through Shared Lives in Scotland actually grew by 77%. So it is a very small proportion of the social care sector in Scotland at the moment, but it is one that has been growing. And we recently saw, for example, Scottish Borders Council commission a new Shared Lives service.
So it's small but expanding.
Exactly, yes.
So what are the barriers to developing Shared Lives services?
Yeah, I think one of the key barriers is just that lack of public awareness. People haven't heard of Shared Lives and they don't know what it is. And so you find that the majority of Shared Lives carer recruitment tends to operate through word of mouth. So people might see their friend working as a Shared Lives carer and they think, oh, I that's something that I could enjoy. So when a Shared Lives scheme gets quite big, there's lots of word of mouth recruitment and it grows quite organically, but it can be a slow process at the start when you're just developing a Shared Lives service. And Shared Lives carers are approved by an independent panel. They have to go through a very rigorous recruitment and assessment procedure and extensive training, much like you do in fostering. And that is going to take a minimum of 2 or 3 months, maybe up to 6 months. So it can be quite a slow process at the start. But at the same time, Shared Lives Plus at the moment, we are We've got a short-term project to support the creation of an online recruitment and training portal, and trying to speed up that lengthy process and increase carer numbers during the pandemic.
Okay, thanks, Leslie. That was great. That was a really interesting overview of how the Shared Lives model works. But we're really keen to bring in people with some direct experience of this. So joining us now is Abby Farrell, who has benefited from a Shared Lives scheme herself, as well as Abby's Shared Lives carer, Louise Kennedy. So Abby, I'm going to come to you first. Can you start by telling us about your life before the Shared Lives scheme?
So my life before the Shared Life scheme was quite hectic. I used to be a lookout for prostitutes, and I used to always drink and do drugs, but that was my way of coping with what was happening at home. My mum was going through domestic violence. My stepdad would batter my mum, and vice versa, like they would attack each other, and then my stepdad also once a few times has attacked me as well. So I used to drink and do drugs to be a lookout. So I didn't have to cope with what was happening at home. And I also used to go robbing just so I could get food because I was so hungry. And I was homeless for a wee while. I was staying on people's couches and I was sleeping on the floors because I had nowhere to go. My mum would give me £20 with a bin bag full of clothes, say, there you go. And they would go off to Dubai, Spain, everywhere. And I would be stuck at home with nowhere to go. So it was horrible.
And then I think you said to me earlier that then you moved to Scotland. And then you chose a Shared Lives scheme. So why did you choose Shared Lives?
I would say, when I lived with my auntie first for like 18 months, and then my social worker at the time said, do you want to come into the Shared Life scheme? And I said, what's that? And then she told me, you can go and live with someone, a family or just a couple. And so luckily I knew, like before Andrew and Louise, I knew Andrew before. So when the social worker said, I've got a couple, Louise and Andrew, the social worker then came to Louise and Andrew and said, there's a girl that needs fostered or like the Shared Life scheme, and named Abby. And Andrew said, I know who she is, because funny enough, we were part of a group we used to go to, and he said to everyone, do not go upstairs on the bus. So I goes upstairs on the bus with my headphones and gets lost, and they left me on the bus. So I knew straight away that I would fit in with Louise and Andrew straight away. So that's how I got to live with them. I came for one day for my dinner, and I've never left for like 11 years.
So can you tell us more about your Shared Lives arrangement now with Louise?
Louise and Andrew. I live with Louise and Andrew, who are my Shared Lives carers. And I live with also my dog called Derek. And I go and spend, I'll see Andrew's family quite a lot. I go and see them. I go on trips with them. I go and visit Andrew's mum without Andrew or Louise. Andrew's sister's just moved to Dunbar. Andrew's niece lives in Dunbar, so we're quite a close family, eh? We're quite close. Like, we spend lots of time together as a family. We're quite family-oriented, so it's really nice.
Yeah, that sounds great. So can you tell us, what would your life have been like if it weren't for Shared Lives?
I'd probably be pregnant or dead or living on the street still, because my life was so hectic. I used to go to rob. This girl said if I didn't rob out of a certain shop, she was going to batter me. So I had to go and rob from a certain shop. And now, like, when I go into that shop, I literally have a panic attack, because I'm so worried that, because what I've done in the past and what my life was like, that, you know, that it would come back to me, but my life was so bad.
That just shows the difference it's made to your life.
Yeah, totally.
Can you tell us about, so what's life been like during the pandemic? So we're about 10 months on now since the start of lockdown. How's it been for you guys?
I'm not going to lie, it has been hard, like, not seeing my family, because my family in Liverpool, I'm seeing my friends, because I'm so used to seeing my friends, and because I've got a certain, like, routine of seeing my friends, and, like, it's, now that's just gone completely, it's quite hard, but with Louise and Andrew and Derek, if I didn't have Derek and Louise and Andrew, I would be totally well worse off than what I am. So, Louise and I walk Derek quite a lot, and spend time with Louise and Andrew walking, just spend time with the family is really good. I feel like we've got closer since the pandemic as well, so it's helped.
Yeah, I think this time everyone's been forced to think about what's really important in life.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm going to bring in your shared lives carer, Louise, now. So hi, Louise.
Hi.
Can you tell us how you got involved with shared lives, please?
By accident, a happy accident. I was working in the care sector and going in and out of people's houses. And I worked with a lady, a colleague, and she was a bit eccentric, but really got on well. And one day she rang me and she said, oh, you need to come to the house. I've got a social worker coming. And I immediately thought, social worker, something wrong. Oh my goodness. And belched round to her house. And there was a social worker there, right enough. And she was inquiring about doing respite care. I just kind of sat in the room like a spare part, really why I was there. And then did a lengthy conversation with the social worker, going to great pains to explain what respite care was about and all the rest. My friend turned around and went, oh no, that wouldn't suit me. She'll do it though. And I was like, what? And I said, no, I'm in a stable job, you know. But one day I came home from work and there was a free newspaper sitting and it was for Midlothian for respite care, and I rang up. I just had a bad day at work and it was just, you know, knee-jerk reaction. And she said, oh, you don't qualify for this area because you live in East Lothian. But what she did, she got in touch with the social work department without me knowing. It was great, really good of her. And the original social worker who I'd met, my friends, rang me back. And that's how the whole process started. And we started our training and going through the application process. And at first we did respite care. It could be short, it could be long. And then we got the chance of Abby coming to stay with us. And she just fitted in like that. There was no kind of slow build up. You know, we imagined that Abby would be coming for tea, coming to spend a day, graduating to an overnight. She came for her tea, which I burnt, but that really broke the ice. And remember that. And she moved in. And it was unique because Abby never had to say to us, oh, is it okay if I make a cup of tea? Is it okay if I do this? It was like she had always been here. I mean, it really, really was. And now I think, what did we do without Abby before? You know, She's been with us 12 years now. And it's we've had ups, we've had downs, but we're family.
I bet those 12 years have flown by.
Really can't believe it. Can't believe it.
I've been in Dunbar for 13 years from Liverpool. I've never thought I would be here that long. I only was coming for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And now I'm here. Just like that.
But we're trying to encourage Abby to have the same kind of life that her peers have. You know, and we're always aware of our safety. But if Abby wants to go up to Edinburgh and have a night out with friends, you know, we encourage that.
With about 25,000 phone calls.
Yes, yes.
The first night I went out in Edinburgh, she was on the phone of every hour.
Like, but it's hard letting go. It's really hard. It's, you know, and I know what it was like to be Abby's age. So, you know.
But I'm getting too old to be staying out that late now. Can't hack it no more.
I miss those days.
So do yeah, I. Yeah, when I can yeah. hack it, but I can't hack it anymore.
So, Louise, is anything surprised you about your shared lives experience?
It's something I never realised the importance or how significant a scheme it was. You know, I just kind of bobbed along. This is life, you know, and we've got Abby, and I don't think of it like a job at all, never have. And it was the night we were invited to Parliament, and they laid on a beautiful buffet, and there was anyone was there. And I think that's the night I thought, oh Jesus, we're part of something really big and special here, you know.
Especially when we're doing the talk at Parliament. We done a talk at Parliament and there was loads of people and it was really scary. But once I'd done it, I felt really good. I felt like I've achieved something in life. But I think without the scheme, like without Shared Lives and Louise and Andrew, I would never have gone to college and done psychology, sociology, SVQ2 and social health and social care and all stuff like that. I've never ever have done that. So, like, honestly.
Abby was always told, you can't do this, you can't do that.
So that sounds really, really positive. But going into it, did you have any concerns about it?
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Because I was really happy in my existing job, really happy. And I thought, am I crazy? What am I? I'm just jumping into the unknown here. But I've never regretted it. Never regretted it. We have a lot of good support around us. You know, social work.
Leslie.
Get a lot of slating. But we have struck gold with our social workers, you know. Yeah. They're brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Great. Well, it's been fantastic to speak to you all today. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert, for taking the time to have us.
Thanks, guys, and thanks to you for listening. Remember, you can subscribe to the Fraser of Allenders podcasts on all major podcast platforms, and you can read the report that we discussed at the beginning of this podcast, including an easy read version on our website, fraserofallender.org. There's a special section on our learning disabilities work, fraserofallender.org/learning-disabilities. And there's plenty more to discuss in the coming weeks, including the launch of our election analysis. So we'll see you again soon.